Okay, Shalom Aleichem. The truth is that until we get to Hanukkah, it may take some time. So that's why I'm going to start with the connection to Hanukkah, then work through what I really want to lay down. And if we don't get to it this week, maybe we'll get to it next week. We know that women have a special place in Hilchos Hanukkah. There's a special halacha that while the candles are lighting for that half hour, women should not be doing malacha. Exactly what the extent of that is, this is not a halacha shir now, but we'll say you should, in a general way, it should be a half yom tov kind of situation. You're sitting, you can fry latkes, that you can do that, but you shouldn't be involved in serious household chores at that time. This is a din that's specific to women, not to men, because of the special place that women have in the Nes of Hanukkah. What's that special place? There's really two, a number of aspects are spoken about by the Poskim, but first of all, on one sense, on one level, women had a greater tzara than men. There was the part of the tzara that affected all of Klal Yisrael, but women specifically, there was that very bizarre gezeira that a woman who was getting married had to be taken by the local governor or commander first. Now, besides that, we don't have to elaborate on this, on what this means. But there was such a gzeira in place, and as we'll see soon, this is part of the essence of Yavon's struggle against Klal Yisrael. This was not just a random gzeira. They were trying to do something very specific here. So in a sense, the women were fighting. They had this whole added dimension to the terrible gzeira that was encompassing all of Klal Yisrael. Besides that, we also know that the women had a special share in bringing about, one of the aspects of the Yeshua in the whole story of Yehudis, which again, I'm imagining that everybody is familiar with in a general way. We're not going to get into the details of that either, but everybody knows the story. Now, I'd like to try to connect to that on a little bit of a deeper level, if you will, by analyzing, Taka, the woman's very special role and understanding how what Yavon was trying to do, while it certainly was coming up against all of Klal Yisrael, in a sense, it was Mamish taking the Jewish women on her turf. Now, let's understand that. And here also, we'll spend 2 more minutes talking about Yavon before we get to our subject. And then, like I said before, we might forget about Hanukkah until next week. Let's see. Galus Yavon is one of the 4 galuyos, right? We know that there are 4. This characterizes history in a general way. There was Galus Bavel, right? The Babylonians who destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. There was the Paras, the Persians. There was Yavon, the Greeks, and then there's Rome, which is the Gaulus we're still in until today. It's important to realize that even though we talk today about being in Gaulus Edom, the Gaulus of Rome, the Gaulus of Yavon is not finished. The Gaulus of Yavon is contained in the Gaulus of Edom, meaning we're still struggling against the effect of Yavon. The way a Rebbe of mine explained this is as follows. So let's note a couple of unique things about Galus Yavon. Galus means exile. Yavon was actually the one Galus where the Jews were not exiled in the simple sense. Galus Yavon, the Jews were in Eretz Yisrael. The Beis HaMikdash was standing. For a large part of it, the Beis HaMikdash was actually functioning, reached the point where they defiled the Beis HaMikdash. But for a large part of it, they were actually functioning. But Yavon was somehow a galus that didn't conflict with the Jewish people being in their land, living in their land, etc. And the truth is that, again, we're going to touch on this briefly now, but this is the way my Rebbe put it, was that the essence, contrary to the other galus who wanted to conquer, to destroy, to Yavon had a different style. They wanted to infiltrate and defile from within. This is what they wanted to do. Let there be a Beis HaMikdash. But we want to defile what's going on there. Let there be a Jewish nation. We're not out there lahashmid laharig la'abid. We're not Hamans. We want to taint the purity of the Jewish nation. We want to hit them from the inside. We want to get to the inside. Right? That's why we also have the Nisyavnim, the Hellenizers, was such a major feature in the whole story. We don't have Babylonizers, or however you would say that. We don't have Misparsim, right? We don't have any of that. We have Nisyavnim. Same idea. I want to hit you from the inside. Get to the inside and bring our influence through from the inside. Okay? Now, like I said, we're going to put Hanukkah on hold now. And what I want to do now is really study a portrait of two of the greatest women in our history. I'm saying two of the greatest women in our history. Devorah HaNeviah and Chana, the mother of Shmuel. The reason I want to study them is to use them as examples of where the greatness of the Jewish woman lies. Of course, everybody knows that Orthodox Judaism puts women down, don't have respect for women, right? If you've never experienced it growing up in Orthodox Judaism, you've certainly heard about it from the outside. Everybody outside knows that, even if you haven't experienced it. But now, that very much has to do with the fact that, say, 1 minute. If you say, come and say that a woman's primary place is her home, so of course you're cutting her out of all true achievement. You're cutting her out of all true achievement. Now, that's true if there are a couple of premises in place. First of all, there's one premise that the home is not something special, right? That the home is just like where you go to put your head down. But where it's really happening is out there in the big world. If we agree with that, and it's true. If we're saying that your primary role is in the home, so we've relegated you to an inferior place. But the truth is that that itself comes from another premise, and that is that it's all about what you see happening on the outside. Internal achievement that is not outwardly advertised is not worth much. And therefore, once again, something that's going on in the inner, deeper level, come on, what's that worth? But if we understand that in Yiddishkeit, we have an attitude of Moshe Beruchai Miloikid here, which basically means you have a great general who, you have an Eisenhower, you have an Eisenhower, right? The victorious general of World War II. And he accomplished what he accomplished, right? And he went down in history as one of the great names in history, right? I said, as far as we're concerned, if you have a person who has certain midas struggles going on within himself, and he takes on those battles, he decides he's going to make a battle within his family. He has midas struggles that are affecting his shalom bayis with his wife, that are affecting his relationship with his children, and he recognizes that. Decides, I'm going to take the bull by the horns, and that bull is me, and I am going to wage battle against those midas, against those struggles. I'm going to conquer. And he does. He puts in a campaign to battling his own raw instincts, and he ends up improving his relationships, turning them into something beautiful. That is the hero in our value system. That's the hero in our value. If you look up in Shemayim, the general achieved important things, no question about that. We're not going to take that away from him. But we're talking about a person who has built magnificent edifices that here in Olam Hazeh, what are you going to see? Not going to see much. He didn't make himself into a Gadol Ador. He made himself into as much of a mensch as his neighbor is. But Moshe Beruchai Miloikei De'ir. We have a pasuk that says, as far as we're concerned, the person who successfully conquers what's going on inside of himself, successfully conquers himself and brings himself under his own reign, a reign dictated by his higher desires, as far as we're concerned, he's on a higher pedestal. You won't see it in this world. You won't see it in this world. In this world, he's not going to be a hero. But in the next world, this is a person who's going to be shining brilliantly. And on the contrary, as Jews, we're trying to get our sensitivities into a place that we do learn to admire such a person more than we might admire a very great achiever. Now let's talk about two women. Devorah HaNeviah was a phenomenon. She, in a certain sense, in the period of the Shoftim, basically from the time of the beginning of the Shoftim, this is something that really deserves a lot of elaboration, but things were starting to head downhill. Not like this, but like this, with ups and downs, but they were in a general way heading downhill. And back in those great days, the spiritual and material state of affairs were completely hand in hand, meaning as soon as the spiritual standards started dropping, the material state of affairs started dropping too. And it manifested in enemies being able to gain power over the Jewish people. And there was a very, very set pattern of the Jewish people sliding. Then an enemy coming onto the scene, oppressing them. And then the Jewish people being awakened by the right shliach, whoever the shofet would have been, whoever the messenger would have been, them doing tshuva, and then Hashem providing the salvation through that shofet. This was a pattern. Devorah HaNeviah brought that to a whole new level. She, what happened in her time, everyone's familiar with the story in a general way, and we're not going to be able to get into the whole story now, but she put the Jewish people through experiences that were equivalent, not exactly, but equivalent to what they experienced at Kriyas Yamsuf, things that were unprecedented since they had come into Eretz Yisrael. And she moved the Jewish people into a whole new era. Let's talk about her a little bit. So she's described in the first pasuk where she's introduced on the scene. It says, "Devorah isha neviah ishes lapidos." Isha ishes Yisrael b'Yisai. Devorah was a neviah. You have to already understand what the significance of that is. A Navi was not something that happened haphazardly. A Navi involved years of work, of working on your character. A Navi had to have very, very great accomplishments, very accomplished in the realm of Avedas Amidas, had to have complete self-control over themselves, and also very, very great accomplishments in the realm of connection with Hashem, awareness of Hashem. If you look in the Rambam has a long description of quite what it took to come to Nevuah. It was a very, very rigorous years involved in really, really working on yourself in many, many different ways until you could come to Nevuah. And a Navi was a very, very great person. We had many such people in those great days. We had 1.2 million Navim in those 800 years. Before that, from the time of Moshe until Nevuah seized. So Devorah was a very great woman, and she is described as Eshes Lapidos. Woman, it's a wife of, or woman of Lapidos. Lapidos means flames. What does that mean exactly? So between Chazal and the Mefarshim, we have three main explanations of what that means. Eshes Lapidos. One shot is that she was a fiery woman. She operated with a lot of zeal. She was passionate. Eshes Lapidos. She was a fiery, flaming woman. It was a personality. Pshat number two is, and soon we're going to bring all three together to show how they connect in a very, very profound way. Pshat number two is that her husband's name was Lapidos. Eshes Lapidos. She was the wife of Lapidos. Okay. Pshat number three is that she was a woman of flames in a technical sense. What does that mean? She made it a habit, if you'll call it that, to make wicks for the menorah of the Beis HaMikdash. That was her thing. She made, it wasn't the Beis HaMikdash, the Mishkan. She made wicks for the Mishkan. And she would send them with her husband. So she was an Eshes Lapidos. She was a woman of flames, meaning she used to make wicks. Her thing was dedicating wicks to be used in the menorah of the Beis HaMikdash. So now we have to understand how these three come together. Chazal tell us that this business of making wicks for the menorah of the Beis HaMikdash was not just about making wicks for the menorah of the Beis HaMikdash. There was a completely different motive here. Her husband, whatever this means in those times, her husband was a simpleton. Her husband was a simpleton. Her way of elevating him was, she made these wicks, and she would send him to deliver them to the Mishkan. Being in the vicinity of the Mishkan was something that had a very, very big effect on people. We don't appreciate now what that was, but I'll just say this, and again, this is something that I think we elaborated on this back when we spoke back in the 3 weeks. But I'll just say this, that as rich of a Yiddishkeit as we might think we have now, the difference between that and the experience of life at the time of the Beis HaMikdash, the first Beis HaMikdash, I mean. Second Beis HaMikdash was already more like our reality. As we already mentioned before, it was already beginning with the Golos. But in the first Beis HaMikdash, when we had Nevuah pulsing in Klal Yisrael, the way the Kuzari puts it is, it's like the difference in vitality between a dry, dead bone and a live, robust person. So what we have, Baruch Hashem, a rich, pulsing Yiddishkeit today, we have to realize how feeble that is relative to what Yiddishkeit meant when you lived with the open presence of the Shekhinah. Now that's a big discussion, and we're not going to be able to get into that now. But this very much had to do with the experience. This very much had to do with the experience, the fact that Jewish people were constantly being exposed to what was going on in the Mishkan. Now again, I want to hold back from tangents here, even though they're important. So I just want to leave it at that. Really, this should be elaborated on in order to really appreciate it. But we'll just say this, that the Mishkan, the Beis HaMikdash, provided a life's blood to the Jewish people. It went to the Regel 3 times a year. It was a refreshing, it was a reinforcement, it was a revitalizing of your spiritual vitality.
For the Mishkan also?
What's that?
Same for the Mishkan,
except in the years when there were problems there. And that's part of what we'll be discussing when we're talking about Elkanah and Chana. But the same for the Mishkan, yes, the whole reality of the Avodah there. So, what was her way of elevating her husband? She sent him to with these wicks on a regular basis. He was constantly being exposed to the Avodah and the Mishkan. Thereby, he was being elevated. Now, let's appreciate this. This was a woman who ultimately became a leader in Klal Yisrael. A very unusual phenomenon, certainly in those times, right? She became a leader in Klal Yisrael, but let's realize, she did not turn that into a career. She is praised for what other Shechtim are criticized for. She, it says, if you know the continuation, she was the Shefet of Klal Yisrael at that time. She sat under the palm tree of Doira, meaning we're stressing, the Bnei Yisrael used to come to her for Mishpat, meaning she was not out there going around teaching Klal Yisrael. She stayed home. People wanted to come to her, they came to her. In fact, she didn't even really have formal authority. Her role as a shefet of the Bnei Yisrael was because, and this is something to the credit of Klal Yisrael at that time, they recognized her greatness and they submitted themselves to her leadership. They submitted themselves to her instruction. There was nothing formally binding about it. It could be that at a later stage something changed, but again, at the time when she says she shefet as Yisrael, it was because her greatness was recognized and they submitted themselves to her. Even that wasn't all of Klal Yisrael. But this was what was going on. And she is praised for the fact that she stayed home. People wanted to come to her, were welcome to come. Whereas other Shaiftim were criticized for that. Why are you just staying home? Klal Yisrael needs you. You should be circling and spreading the influence. That's what Shmuel HaNavi did. And we see that the earlier Shaiftim are criticized for not doing that. She's praised for not doing that. Now, so in other words, she was not on a path of growing in the role of leadership. She didn't set herself on such a path. She was at home. Like it says, Shakamti Ein Bi Yisrael. That's how she describes herself. At Shakamti Devaro, Shakamti Ein Bi Yisrael. She was a mother in Klal Yisrael. If other people wanted to avail themselves to her motherhood, she was available for all. But she wasn't changing into something else. Now, okay. Back to this business with her husband. Try to imagine a woman of this level. She's obviously a very deep woman. If she was able to get to the qualifications of Nevuah, she is obviously a very deep woman. She was a passionate woman. This was a superstar, right? And she ends up marrying to, again, I don't know what this means, but whatever exactly the term means in Chalai, Am Aretz, a simpleton. Naturally, we might expect that she would kind of be like, this is just not shidduch, right? This is not my level. What was her approach? On the contrary, she took all of those koichas. Koichas that, as we're seeing now, ultimately were capable of guiding both Kali Yisrael, and she threw them into what can she make out of her husband? How can she elevate him at his level? Not complaining about that he's not on a higher level, but this was where she was going to take all of her immense koichas and she was going to put them into elevating her husband. Now, Rabbi Avigdor Miller once made a sharp statement when he was speaking against the whole women's lib business at one point. He said, anybody who's been exposed to him knows that he was very sharp. Okay. He said, now people are going to come out of here saying that I'm opposed to women, but I'll tell you the truth, I'm opposed to men too. So, and that very much it captures his style. At one point, someone asked him, what should a woman do if she's smarter than her husband? What should you know if she's smarter than her husband? So he said something very profound. He said, if she is wise enough, her wisdom will prevail. Her husband, her wisdom will guide the home without her husband realizing it. He'll think that he is the, right? She will use her wisdom to set it up that way. This is Mamish the pasuk that we call Chokhmas Nashim Bansabesa, right? It's the wisdom of the woman that builds the home. And this was, look at this example of Dvaira, right? Where would all her greatness be? She would be wasted on just this one man. I could be teaching the masses out there. That's how she saw it. She saw it that her role in history, yes, Hashem gave her all those kreiches for raising her husband. And again, like we said, she ended up becoming a shayfet in Klal Yisrael. But that was because Klal Yisrael came to her. It didn't come from a place of, I'm wasted on this nincompoop. I could be achieving so much more. No, that's where she saw her greatness. In other words, oh boy, we have a lot ahead of us here. I mean, we're only going to be starting this subject this week. Okay, I hope we'll end up getting back to Hanukkah. Okay? likely. Now, before we draw our conclusions on this, before we wrap this up, I want to move straight into Chana. And then afterwards, bring it all together in order to really appreciate, there's a lot to be appreciated here. Appreciate what the meaning is of what we call a Bayis V'Yisrael. What a charged place that unit is, right? We call it Bayis V'Yisrael. I'm going to interject here with one little story about Shlomo Zalman Auerbach that brings out the point, just because I want to be already setting the sights, even though it might take us a while to get to where we want to get. But there's a story about Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, a very famous story, but I often think that the way it's told misses the immensity of the story. That he was one time coming home. He was escorted by a few Talmidim, and as he approached his house, he stopped outside for a moment, and he made himself presentable. He set himself up. I don't know exactly what he did. I heard the story once told that he straightened his tie, but he didn't wear a tie. So that's not that's not how it went. But he whatever it is, he made himself presentable, made sure he was looking good before he walked into the house. And he said to his Talmidim, it says that Zalchu Ish V'Isha Shechina Shreya Beinayim, when there's things are proper between the man and his wife, Shechina Shreya Beinayim. He said, I'm about to walk into a Makam HaShechina. You have to be presentable before you do that. It's often presented in the context of like a shalom bayis. Make sure you're looking good for your wife. Make sure you're looking good for your husband. That's true. But that's not what Reb Shlomo Zalman said. That is true. But you're missing the immensity of the point that he made. He's saying, I'm walking into a zone of Kedusha here. You understand, before we approach the Kaisel, right? Okay, you might do Kriya. But you understand that you shouldn't come there looking like a shlump, right? You step into a shul, there's a halacha, that is da'zeh ma'at, right? A person should tremble considering what he's about to encounter now, the zone that he's walking into. So appreciating that when you're stepping into a proper bayis b'Yisrael, you're walking into a zone of charged kedusha. That's the point that he was making here, to appreciate that, right? So that's the idea here, to be appreciating quite what that means. And then we'll appreciate quite what it is that's being entrusted in the hands of the Ein B'Yisrael. This is hard turf. Now let's move on to Chana. We already alluded earlier, and I know, we kind of left Devorah hanging. We're going to get back to Devorah when we're ready to tie this all up. Okay? We already alluded earlier to a period, a low period in the time of the Mishkan. The Mishkan stood in Shiloh. Well, it stood in a few different places. But the Mishkan stood for about 400 years. It was approximately the period between the Mishkan and the first Beis HaMikdash before the first Galus was approximately a little more than 800 years divided between the Mishkan and the Beis HaMikdash. The Mishkan, in the time, there was this couple named Elkanah and Chana. The Mishkan in that time had fallen into a certain disrepair. There were a lot of problems there. Again, everything that comes up here deserves elaboration. I'm trying to just push past all those temptations and keep focused. And tragically, what happened was, as a result of a few different factors, the going to the Mishkan was mamish dropping. People barely came to the Mishkan. People who did came in a very perfunctory way. Came to be Yotze and you left. We said before that the Mishkan was supposed to be the source of vitality of Klal Yisrael. Since it wasn't, the Matzav in Klal Yisrael in general was at a certain low. It wasn't like in later times when Imamish had, you know, Tzedukim, you had Misyavnim. It wasn't like that. Everyone was from. But it was dry. It was kind of like mechanical. It wasn't that freshness. It wasn't that enthusiasm. It wasn't passion. It wasn't connection. And it was because of the fact that the Mishkan was kind of like not really happening. At that time, just to illustrate, again, we said that there were 1.2 million Nevi'im in Klal Yisrael, pretty much spanning those 800 years. If you make a cheshbon, it comes out to approximately 1,500 Nevi'im a year being produced, which means that in a generation, call a generation, about 40 years, you should have something like 60,000 Nevi'im in Klal Yisrael. Meaning, at any given time, there should be Nevi'im all over the place. One time I tried to make a cheshbon, it came out approximately that you had like, in if we're talking in our terms, you had a Navi in every couple of buildings. That's how it comes out approximately. Now, in those times, in that time, there were 200 Nevi'im in Klal Yisrael. Which is, again, it's illustrating the low that they were on. Okay? Elkanah was a very, very great man and a very passionate man. He was perhaps the greatest or one of the greatest people in his door. And he couldn't come to terms with that. He just couldn't handle a situation of this disconnect between Klal Yisrael and Hashem. He loved Hashem too much and he loved the Jewish people too much. Hashem shouldn't be enjoying a relationship with his children and that these children should be deprived of that warm relationship with their father. He couldn't handle that. What could he do? He's a single individual. Chashav a man, he decided he is just going to single-handedly, right? He didn't have, he wasn't a shayfet, he wasn't the king. He's going to sing, he has to bring, reconnect Jews with Hashem. He dedicated himself to such a thing, couldn't handle that situation. Really, it started with, Chazal tell us, he worked on things properly. He started with his own home. He, I don't know what everybody else is doing, but he used to take his whole family up to the Mishkan, his whole extended family, men, women, children, and make a very, very big, exciting deal out of it. It was a very, very exciting family experience. There's a lot of different chashuv things you can learn for practical chinuch just by studying the story of Elkanah and Chana. Right now, we're prefacing with Elkanah in order to get to our real subject, which is Chana. I might be left with a minute and a half of that, but I'm going to try to move quickly now. And he made a very big deal about it. He came more than required. He came three times a year, the regalim, but besides that, at least another time a year. And he made it into a very exciting family experience, which brought his family to a very high level. But he wasn't satisfied with that. What's with the rest of the Jewish people? So he made it a mahalach. What he would do is, he'd call it the whole extended family, which slept along brothers and sisters also. And he would go, they would all go together to the Mishkan, but they would dafka go through the towns. Instead of going like through the roads, go through the town, set up camp right in the middle of the town, make a big deal of commotion, right? Screaming babies, diapers, this, that, all, you know, a bunch of families, all extended family just plunking down in this town street, right? And people would come over to find out what's going on. You want to know where we're going? We're going to the Mishkan. Do you know what it's like in the Mishkan? And he would arouse their nostalgia. He would arouse their nostalgia. Every time he went, he would move people to tears. And there would always be a few more people who would join. In each town that he passed through, a few more people. He said, come with us, join us, come with us for the experience. Every town that he went through, he hopped on a few more people. And each time he would go a very different route. Each time he would go through different towns until he single-handedly, because of his tenacity, because of his vision, because of his fire, reversed the situation. You had people, masses, again, it started as a trickle, but the trickle intensified, and you had people, more and more people, until again there was a situation of masses coming to the Mishkan. Hashem said, you put in all this effort to bring my children closer to me, that's why you're going to have a child who's going to do that on a mass national scale. Now let's move over to his wife, Chana. We all know the story about Chana being childless. You have to understand that there's a lot more going on there. Why was Chana childless? First, let's understand that. Why was Chana childless? You know why Chana was childless? The situation was deteriorating in Klal Yisrael. It had reached a certain low. The period of the Shoftim had basically exhausted itself. You have to understand what the period of the Shoftim was like. The period of the Shoftim was no central government. There wasn't an organized army. It was a reality of Hashem hu malkichem. This is right what Shmuel says. When the people asked for a king, what does Shmuel say? Why do you need a king? Hashem hu malkichem. For 400 years, the Jewish people were living with the reality of they didn't need a central government. I'm sorry. Hello? Yeah. Yeah. Oh, okay, so about 4 minutes. I'm going to call you. You know, you can just call the school. Just tell them, and then I'll call Miriam. No, figure it out. I'll call Miriam. Okay. Oh, okay, fine. So I'll call you in 3 minutes. Sorry, I always say this is due to very unusual circumstances. We'll tie things up, and then Mitzvah Hashem will continue next week. Okay. The period of Shoftim was ending, nearing its end. They had been a self-governing people for about 400 years. People think, superficially, Isha Yashar Bein Ovyas, it sounds like a terrible period, right? Each man did what was right in his own eyes. And it was backwards until they finally got it together and put together a kingship. If a nation is backwards without a kingship, they don't survive for 50 years. You can't have a situation of no government for 400 years and everybody's still alive because they were backwards. It was exactly the other way around. They were on a very, very high level. Yishar Asher Be'enov, Bavigdor Miller used to stress, has to be taken very literally. People did what was right in their eyes means that every individual was trying to live as rightly as he can. This caused problems. And as those problems accumulated, it reached a point where it couldn't continue. But for 400 years, this was a brilliant period in Klal Yisrael. It's also something that deserves elaboration. But to get to our point right now, it was reaching its end. The Jewish people would have to have a king. It would take a very, very great person to move the transition, to guide that transition, to be there at the cradle of Malchus and Yisrael, and to guide Klal Yisrael and this new king into that new reality. It would have to be a man, like Chazal say, in a certain way was equivalent to Moshe and Aaron together. That also needs elaboration, not now. Who is that man going to be? He has to be born to very special parents. Hashem chose that couple, Elkanah, and perhaps even more, Chana was the woman who Hashem decided, this is the woman to raise that child. But Hashem said, I want it to be even greater. How am I going to raise her to an even greater level? I'm going to put her through a period of childlessness, which will bring out of her such tefillas, such connection, that will raise her even higher and ready her for that great role. And also, the child that will then be born will be the result of all those tefillas. And that's why Chana was put through this ordeal. She was being readied to be put in a mamish, in a very pivotal place in the whole history of Klal Yisrael. She would be the one responsible for raising that child who would then change the face of Jewish history. And here I'll just end with the point, and we'll have to come back to it next week. The difference between Chana and Elkanah, both of them were very much hurting over the state of Klal Yisrael. She was hurting over her childlessness. But no less so, she was also eaten up by this state in Klal Yisrael. Now, Elkanah responded in a way that in a very great way captures the role of a man. He turned outward and tried to just spread the influence as much as he could. Chana responded by turning inward and telling Hashem, Hashem, give me a child. I want to change all of Klal Yisrael. How am I going to do that? Give me a child. I'm going to change Klal Yisrael in my child. I'm going to change, and her tefillas, her forceful tefillas, which is, we know that we'll discuss this next week. We're coming from that place of Hashem, I can't bear, there's my childlessness here, but there's also your honor here. I can't bear to see this. I'm going to take all my energies and put them into that one child that you give me. That's how I'm going to make my impact. That's how I'm going to make my impact on Klal Yisrael. She turned inward. She turned inward to the role of, again, an Ein B'Yisrael. And we all know the continuation of the story. But the story still deserves more elaboration. Bli Neder, next week. Okay.